From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a photograph. It is arguably the most famous single image of a Southern slave, as historian Robert May notes in his new book. The photograph comes from Harper's Weekly in its 1863 Independence Day issue. The picture was part of a story titled A Typical Negro. It included a Mississippi slave named Gordon, and there were three separate images. May writes that the photograph on the left side of the page depicted Gordon in the clothing he wore after arriving on Union battle lines. The photo on the right showed Gordon armed and dressed in military clothing. But the photograph in the center was the largest, and it was a very different image. Gordon was seated, and we could see his bare back. It was heavily scarred from lashes. And as the story explains, Gordon sustained those lashes and scars on the previous Christmas Day, a Christmas lashing. You've probably seen that image without realizing that the torture Gordon endured was a kind of twisted Christmas gift from a white master. If it surprises you that this enslaved man would have been tortured on Christmas Day, that's because there has been a decades-long campaign to convince you that while slavery was a horrific institution, well, at least many slave masters were kind during the holidays. Enslaved families could often expect a little extra time and food, maybe even gifts to open. Well, it turns out much of that is nonsense. The reality is far grimmer. As May writes, quote, "Gordon's scarring raises some important issues for consideration. Had this so-called typical Negro received atypical treatment the previous Christmas? Or was his story representative of other Southern slaves who were punished rather than feted by their owners at Christmas?" End quote. Robert May is back in the Finger Lakes region for a discussion on Southern memory, narratives, and reality. He visited last year and spoke to our partners at WEOS about the debate over taking down Confederate monuments that this country has been having. Well, this time he's talking about how we might comfort ourselves with a fairy tale instead of grappling with our truth. May is a professor emeritus of history at Purdue University, and he's speaking right next door to the Seward House in Auburn, where he will be a guest. That event is Thursday evening. We'll tell you about that coming up. But first, he's our guest right here on Connections. And Professor May, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here.
Also with us is Jeff Ludwig, the Director of Education for the Seward House Museum, which is hosting Bob May once again. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to be back.
And Jeff reached out to us with a number of things. There's always a lot going on at the Seward House in Auburn. And this is a guest you've had in the past. Why did you want to bring back Professor May?
We've been really fortunate to have a deep and long friendship with Professor May. He came, like so many, as a house visitor, was, I think, fair to say, mesmerized, blown away by some of the collections and stories that we tell. And he and I had a conversation that resulted in, this is the third time he's come back. He gave a great talk for us. He's a specialist in his field in the Civil War era, first on Seward foreign policy. Secondly, how really, and not that long after the incidents at Charlottesville, do we deal with Confederate monuments and memorials? And a spellbinding talk that was one of the most powerful I've ever been a part of. He reached out to me that he'd finished this new book and was going to be coming through the area. We got a copy of it. He's one of my favorite speakers that we're ever privileged to have at the museum. So we asked him to once again come and please be our guest.
Thursday night, 7 o'clock. What do people need to know, Jeff?
So it's a free event for any of our museum members. If you're not one, you should be one. Otherwise, only $5. We want this event to be accessible and affordable. If it's been a while since you were in Auburn, we're hosting it right next door at the brand new New York State Equal Rights Heritage Center at 25 South Street in downtown Auburn. And that is also a site worth checking out. So maybe make a day Thursday. Go to the Tubman site. If you've seen the movie, you really need to come and see that. And visit us as well and learn about the intersections of Harriet Tubman's story and Seward history, and stay for an incredible evening's lecture and book signing.
Professor May, I had seen that photo before of Gordon. I think many Americans have. I never would have connected it to a Christmas lashing. Why did you want to open the book with that imagery?
Because I think it totally subverts the common wisdom about slave Christmases. The common wisdom is that they partied all the time, maybe for a week, maybe for a month, that they got lavish Christmas gifts, that they were given all sorts of time off to visit the nearest city or town, relatives on other plantations, that they spent their time dancing, giggling, partying, barbecues, and things like that. And I felt that I wanted to grab the reader's attention with something that would say there's an alternate reality that they should be considering. and that would be a good jumping off point to analyze not only what physical punishments they endured, but the psychological punishments that were imposed on them during Christmas also, and the material punishments, in the sense that I've seen very little discussion anywhere in any of the literature on the fact that the slave trade continued over Christmas, the domestic slave trade. Masters sold, bought, and thought about buying and selling slaves over Christmas. They didn't just spend their time drinking eggnog with their families and playing Santa Claus and that kind of thing. So I felt that that was an excellent entree into the whole problem I was dealing with.
We're going to come back to the subject of Yuletide and Dixie in just a moment, but just for a little bit of a frame of reference, as Jeff mentioned, Professor May was here, has been here numerous times, but was here last year and spoke to our partners at WEOS about the ongoing national controversy over Southern monuments. And you brought up something that I think connects to Yuletide and Dixie, which is we seem to be susceptible to convincing ourselves that more comfortable narratives are true instead of grappling with the blunter reality. And one of them is just how quickly we were willing to embrace the idea, well, that the Civil War was a fight for various causes, and that narrative propped up pretty quickly itself, didn't it?
Yes, it did come about very quickly, and it's understandable why. White Southerners, who were accustomed to holding much of the political power in the South, and all the political power in the South, and much of the political power in the nation, if you calculate how many presidents were Southerners, cabinet members, influential senators, and so on and so forth, they were very distressed after the Civil War, when suddenly you had Yankee troops in the area, when the North was imposing on them certain rules. African Americans now had the right to vote, hold office. Former Unionists who didn't support the Confederacy and secession could now run for office and achieve it because many Confederates were disenfranchised and so on. So during Reconstruction, white Southerners started fighting back. And how do you fight back? Well, you want to convince both your population and the rest of the country that your cause was legitimate. And to convince people that your cause is legitimate, you definitely underplay slavery as being a motivation for the Confederacy and the Civil War. And what I've argued in speeches and my writing is that there would never have been a Civil War without slavery, that white Southerners, while the average soldier may have marched off to fight for family or for state or what have you, the leaders who took the South out of the Union and provoked the Civil War and who fired the first shot on Fort Sumter, they were almost all slaveholders. And so anyway, you cover that history up, you obscure it by reminiscing about a South, an imaginary South, in which all slaves were happy. They loved their masters loved them. Their masters cared about their slaves' welfare more than their own. The slaves cared about their masters' families more than their own. And this all comes out above all in the Christmas experience. Mm. Many books after the Civil War, right up until about 1930, that were written, there were memoirs, novels, short stories, and so on, written by white Southerners, a lot of white Southern women, in fact. But these books definitely covered over slavery itself and made it seem like the Christmas experience was the ultimate moment to be a slave. You would want to be a slave if you were lucky, you would be a slave. And many of these books and memoirs had whole chapters on the slave Christmas experience, emphasizing how wonderful the slaves had it at the end of the year.
It's kind of our history of yes, but. Yes, there was slavery, but, you know, a lot of people in bondage didn't mind it, that they thought the life was pretty good. Yes, slaves built the White House, but they were fed really well. They had nice meals. Yes, slavery was terrible, but Christmas season was really glorious. We have this history of doing this. Your scholarship, I think, is so valuable, and it's almost a refusal to allow us to fall into that kind of a trap. But when it comes to modern American education, I haven't taken a survey locally. I don't know just how prevalent this is on a national level, but every once in a while you hear about really egregious examples of public school teachers, you know, usually in the South, but not always, talking about slavery wasn't necessarily the cause of the Civil War, or, you know, alternate narratives about the Civil War. When you hear that, I'm curious to know, as a historian yourself, what it raises in you and how often you hear that. How concerned are you about public education and what kids are being taught about the cause of the Civil War?
I think they don't get enough in general about the causes of the Civil War. I do think slavery's covered more these days. Museums are beginning to change their coverage of slavery, and some are addressing it rather aggressively and getting at the oppression, the psychological abuse and issues like that, and they're getting much more realistic about it. But I think the public has this kind of bland knowledge about slavery, and what I try to bring out in the book, for instance, is what goes on in a lot of plantation tours, where a lot of people get their impressions of Southern life before the Civil War. Even the magazine Southern Living I talk about a little bit, because it ran some pieces on Christmas in the Old South, and you know it emphasized the wonderful decorations and the recipes, and slaves were basically absent from these articles. You would think that Christmas occurred on these big plantations and no one did the labor, no one did the backbreaking labor, the punitive labor, and that these events were just marvelous times for everyone. So I hesitate to brand public education today as not being realistic. I'm not a public school teacher, and I imagine that given the change, the media movies like Harriet that have come out, 12 Years a Slave, things mm-hmm. like that. I mean, obviously, the typical school teacher, if he or she is at all informed, is going to know that slavery was not a glorious time for its African-American victims.
Yeah, and listeners, as we get closer to Thanksgiving, I'd love to hear from our listening audience, and you can email me directly if you want, edawson@wxxi.org. I'm always curious to know what we're teaching about Thanksgiving. And by the way, shout out to my 7-year-old school district. They just had a lesson on code talkers, World War code talkers, and I thought it was very appropriate on the material and very age-appropriate about, but still blunt, about dispossession, terrible treatment of Native Americans, and yet the heroic role they played as code talkers. And I thought I was really heartened to hear that, but I'm still curious to see what is changing or not in regards to some of the fairy tales about Thanksgiving. So listeners, if you want to kick me a note, if you're hearing about what's going on in the schools, I'd love to know about that. Jeff, how do you sort of, you know, in maybe our own limited scope here in Western New York, how do you feel about how the Civil War causes are taught?
Great question. Fun aside before I answer it, mm-hmm. Just for listeners to know, it's actually William Henry Seward who convinces Abraham Lincoln to deliver the first Thanksgiving proclamation and set our Thanksgiving date. States used to celebrate different days of Thanksgiving, and as part of the unification efforts of the North during the Civil War, Seward thought it would be a good national thing to do, to all celebrate Thanksgiving together. Getting to schools, I think we work a lot with 11th and 12th grade. They're doing this. Some of them are getting ready for the AP exam or the Regents. And a question they can expect to get asked every year on those exams is, what was the cause of the Civil War? And that seems like such a basic and obvious question. Mm-hmm. But it isn't. And there's even debates, I don't think in New York, but in other states, that a very legitimate, acceptable answer is to give the states' rights defense. I don't see a lot of students coming in, and when we get to the Civil War via the lens of William Henry Seward, who spends much of the 1850s agitating against slavery, runs against Lincoln, many considered him the more radical Republican alternative for 1860. When we get to why do they think the Civil War happened, what was it fought about, most give the answer that I think if I was grading AP exams, I'd be looking for. And they are talking about slavery. They are talking about the sectional tensions of the 1850s, sprinkling in some Seward references. We talk about his part in amping up some of that pressure, and he definitely felt like a minority voice in the 1850s. Back to Bob's point, that was sort of a high watermark for Southern federalism, controlling the White House and the courts and ramming strong federal laws down the throats of Northern states like New York through the Fugitive Slave Act. But we are also, we're hoping to have open conversations with students. So when they talk about states' rights, we don't shoot that down. And I think it's great to have speakers like Bob come in, and I hope people will come to his talk on Thursday and have a give and take and look at sort of the deep and fraught backstory that frames both sides of the debate, because that's still the civil war we're fighting in textbooks and classrooms and culturally right now.
And it's 7 o'clock on Thursday night, and just $5 if you're not a member of the Seward House. It's right next door, as Jeff mentioned, if you want to attend for Professor May's presentation. He's a fabulous communicator. It's why he's here on Connections as well today. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. One more question on Confederate monuments, because I think there's a little less kind of public opprobrium about this now than there was a year or 2 years ago, but we'll probably continue to see a little, I'd say little, they're not little where they happen, but we're probably going to see it in the news as time goes on, to the extent that there are still statues and monuments. You noted to our partners at WEOS last year an important distinction, and I'd like to kind of press that point with you. It's one thing to have a monument or a statue of a Confederate general in the middle of your park, in a public space where there's fountains and flowers, and here's this monument. It's another for it to be on a battlefield or on a historical site. Is that for you going forward the distinction that you think we ought to hold on to?
I think these are very tough questions, but in general, I think that the Confederate leadership knew it was heading for independence and war to defend slavery, and that was the primary purpose, and that's what I would really emphasize, that it was the primary purpose of the entire Confederate experience. States' rights was the kind of cover, it was the gloss on it. They couldn't come out and say to the world, we are seceding from the Union and going into a war that will cost many lives. We are doing that because we're greedy people who own scores or hundreds of slaves, what have you, depending on the Southern leader. They couldn't do that. They badly needed foreign aid, for one thing. The Confederacy was undermanned. It also was underproduced in terms of technology. It greatly needed foreign aid. And if it had gotten more foreign aid, perhaps the Confederacy would have won the Civil War. So you don't go to the world, a world in which the powerful countries that are likely to aid you, like Great Britain, have already abolished slavery. Even Russia got rid of serfdom right about the time the American Civil War started. And you don't go to those countries and say, we're fighting to line our own pocketbooks. No, they go to the public and say, we are fighting for this principle written into the U.S. Constitution of states' rights. And there are a lot of other reasons. You want poor people to fight for your cause. The typical Confederate soldier, of course, owned no slaves at all. About 4/5 of all white Southern families didn't own slaves. You want them to fight for you. And so you emphasize that they're fighting for constitutional principles and home and family. You certainly don't want to tell them that they're fighting for your needs. So I think that's an important thing. Now, to tie it in with Confederate monuments, I don't have a big problem with monuments to fallen soldiers, to the typical fallen soldier, because mm-hmm. the typical fallen soldier didn't cause the Civil War. He's a follower. Some of them were drafted. I don't think that's the real problem. I think the problem is putting up big statues on our streets like Richmond's Monument Avenue and putting up statues to people like Jefferson Davis or P.G.T. Beauregard, Stonewall Jackson, the kinds of statues that were taken down in New Orleans recently, and Memphis had a statue to Nathan Bedford Forrest, who horrifically was very active in the domestic slave trade. He was one of the biggest slave traders before the Civil War. And after the Civil War, he was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. And to put up a monument to such a man who should be despised, and instead we hallow them, and that's what you're asking people to do when you put up a statue in the middle of a town park to a leader like that, I think is a disservice to history. It's in a disservice to human rights, and it's a disservice to our future. So with that said, I think there's a direct tie-in between my book, Yuletide and Dixie, and the whole monuments issue, because if you feel slavery wasn't all that bad, that it was tolerable for its victims, then you not only obliterate history, but you make it very easy for monument defenders or Confederate flag defenders to say, well, we're just venerating our ancestors. They didn't do anything so terrible. They were fighting for what they thought was right, and so on and so forth. So I think there's a real problem with misrepresenting the past and misrepresenting the slave experience that has all sorts of spin-offs.
Let me get a little feedback. Diane in Rochester says, this conversation reminds me of a debate surrounding the Disney film Song of the South. It paints a rosy picture of slavery and Southern life for African Americans during Reconstruction. Many themes in the film can lead viewers to believe that former slaves liked their circumstances.
I love that question, because Joel Chandler Harris, who the movie was based on, his Uncle Remus stories especially, Joel Chandler Harris was very obsessed with painting a good picture of Southern pre-Civil War Christmases. So in his book Nights with Uncle Remus, he has a couple of chapters on the slave Christmas experience. The slaves kind of run the plantation during these times. There's a big slave wedding that the master throws, where the bride has a wonderful gown and the groom is wonderfully bedecked out in fine clothes. And the white boy gets taken down by Remus to this glorious slave party where there's much food, and Remus beats out the rhythms and leads the music. And so, yes, I think that's a prime example of how this stuff seeps into our culture. Some of the most famous authors in the late 19th century and early 20th century wrote about this kind of thing. Thomas Nelson Page was one of the ones who really romanticized the antebellum slave experience, and he emphasized slave Christmas experiences, as did Harris. All sorts of descendants of Confederate veterans and Southern governors from before the Civil War who owned plantations. The Confederate John Gordon was very involved in glorifying Christmas. LaSalle Corbell Pickett, who was the wife of General Pickett of Pickett's Charge, the most famous charge in the Civil War, she wrote a memoir in which she glorified the slave Christmas. So many thousands of Americans, if not millions of Americans, are reading these memoirs, reading these romances, and getting a distorted picture of what went on in slave times. And while I'm on this, I think one of the most important things that I realized as I got into the research for the book was that the Christmas time was often a time of great tension, and it never comes out in these novels and in these memoirs. They never tell you the many masters feared that slaves would take advantage of their off time during Christmas, when they had so much freedom to move about, and they'd actually revolt. They might kill their masters. They might stage a major rebellion throughout the South.
I was going to say, Professor, in our second half hour, I want to touch on that point in particular, because there's a section of your book that that I want to quote from that tells a little bit more about white fears of what either a few free days or weeks at Christmas time, or even post-slavery, what it would look like, and of course how the reality didn't reflect what the fears were based on. Do you want to add to that, Jeff?
I'd love this to hop in for a second and bring William Seward back in. I think it's a great and telling example of the mystique and myth of slavery being perpetuated and the reality. And in the mid-1830s, he's a state senator. William Seward and his family actually take a trip south. They plan to go to Richmond, and they're told that they're very young. They're in their mid-30s. That they're going to see a very mild and genteel form of slavery, and it's exactly the opposite. So a lot of the anti-slavery politics that will inform William and Francis Seward's decision making, whether it's opposing slavery, opening their house up to the Underground Railroad, befriending Harriet Tubman, I think a lot of it is visceral, and it's a lived experience traveling through Virginia, and it seems like, on the surface, the great American vacation. They go to Mount Vernon and Monticello, but they don't make it as far as Richmond, because once they cross into the South, they witness slavery in its most raw and terrible form. The family watches an overseer drive a party of slave children across a dirt road in shackles, and they're tied to a horse's trough and made to drink from it, and they're whipped. they can't stomach anymore, and they turn around and they go home. And a lot of the passion and the eloquence that will come out in the 1840s and the 1850s leading up to 1860, I think it's because they've seen slavery for what it really is and not slavery as they were told how it looked, which was with benevolent plantations and happy all around. So I think a lot of the anti-slavery positions of men like the Sewards comes from actually seeing the exposed lie.
Propaganda was always a part of maintaining and then sort of covering up for the worst sins of slavery. Let's get Jane and then Chris on the phone. Jane first from Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Actually, it's reminiscent, Evan, of what we're going through today with climate change, in that people claim to believe apparently whatever is comfortable to them and won't affect their economic line. So if you don't feel comfortable that you're sort of one of the bad guys with fracking or whatever, you don't believe it conveniently. But I think that's what I kind of see. When you're not comfortable with your identity, say, with the Confederacy, you want to keep the little halo shined, your comfort. I think it has a lot to do with comfort, and it extends in other areas too. People will say of a person, he couldn't possibly abuse his children. It never happened. Or with women, it's a lie she's telling. So it comes to identity and comfort. And I never heard much about any gratuities at Christmas, really. I didn't hear about that so much. But I know in the South, Christmas is really the blowout party of the year for whites and blacks. It doesn't seem to be as much up here. But, you know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine that was very disappointing at one time about beating slaves. And she said the same mythology. She referred back to, oh, no, that never happened. They were valuable, and you wouldn't damage your property. And I wish I had the words that I could find at that moment. That I just said, well, we have pictures of it. You know, the one you referred to, I think, is the one that comes to my mind, mm-hmm. of Gordon. And there was, she just didn't answer to that. But we have photographs. I don't understand, because in that time, there was a legal right to beat your slaves, your children, and your wives. And so what they were saying was, oh, you're telling me they had the legal right, but they refrained from doing it. And that doesn't quite make sense to me. Thank you very much.
Jane, thank you for that. I appreciate that. And you know, Professor May, on her point, it's hard for people to understand. We have photographs. We have enough to know. My best guess in just sort of observing epistemology and the way people sort of go throughout the world forming beliefs, it's almost like you can bifurcate society into two halves, not to oversimplify, but it's those who think that really confronting the darkest parts of who we are is the best way to make us better, and those who think that acknowledging that reality forever sort of stamps us as bad, and we must deny that it was as bad as we probably know it to be.
Yeah, and I think the caller made so many good points. I've just been mulling all of them over in my mind. But I would add that these are complex issues, and they do require a lot of study, because there were slave parties at Christmas, and you don't want to go so far the other way that you obliterate the realities of slavery. Slaves themselves testified in their narratives that they wrote their autobiographies after they ran away, that they were given these parties and these lavish presents and so on and so forth. And when the New Deal sent out writers to interview slaves in the 1930s, they came away with similar stories. The problem is it's been too easy for a lot of people just to focus on a few of these stories and not to listen to what the slaves were also saying. that they knew of many masters in the neighborhood who didn't give their slaves any Christmas at all. They knew of slaves who ran away at Christmas, and the former slaves who said actually that the worst part of Christmas was the psychological abuse. Frederick Douglass talked about how his master tried to get all the slaves drunk at Christmas to demean them and get rid of their sense of self-worth so that he convinced them better they shouldn't run away. They should be his slaves because they didn't know how to take care of themselves. So there are all sorts of sides to this.
I think that's a part of the point that Chris in Rochester wants to make on the phone next. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, well, you confirmed something that I had suspicions about. I thought it was taken from one of Douglass's many autobiographies, which I think is another telling point to look at the psychological effects of slavery. The man wrote, I think, upwards of three autobiographies, just, you know, being deprived, knowing himself in that way, being a slave like that. You don't have a sense of history or origin, but yeah, exactly right. I was calling to ask if anyone else had heard of that account of slave masters purposely letting slaves get drunk, and then the next day they're horribly hungover, and that's an opportunity for the slaveholder to say, now, see, this is why you need supervision. This is why you're in the predicament that you're in. So that was actually the point I was just about to make.
There were some slaves who actually said that their masters forced them to become inebriated, and then he would pull them around and make that point. So, yes, you're absolutely right. And Douglass did write three different autobiographies.
Chris, thank you for that. Maureen writes to say, Evan, great program today. I want to say, as a child of the 1950s in Canada, my family did not buy into such myths as prevalent in Canada as they are here. Maybe that was because my Irish Catholic family descended from indentured servants who may have had time off, not on Christmas, but on Boxing Day. Not to minimize or appropriate African-American history, just to point out that capitalists everywhere see servants as tools, period. That's from Maureen in Canisius. You want to comment on that, Professor?
Well, yeah. I think we need to realize that in part, slaves were valuable to masters for the comforts they provided, the cooking, the cleaning, the, you know, making the beds, all the different things that servants did around the place. But their primary purpose, and they wouldn't have existed at all, they never would have been imported from Africa, was to produce cash crops that could be sold on world markets. And there were great world markets for the primary crops raised in the South, which were cotton, sugar, tobacco, and rice. And on these crops, on these slave crops, the masters made incredible profits. So there have been all sorts of studies in recent years on the relationships of slavery to capitalism. And we now realize that Southern white slave masters and mistresses were among the richest people in America, that slavery slavery produced more profits than Northern railroads or industries, and that it was these profits that were generated that allowed these people to build these magnificent mansions that people tour all year round, but especially at Christmas time in the South. And so the whole, you can't separate slavery from money-making, which is exactly what many of these Christmas romances do. And in fact, many of them have masters sacrificing their self-interest, buying slaves that are old and infirm or crippled on Christmas Day so that they won't have to be in the slave market, providing slaves with gifts that they can't afford. And so the stories that they weave, the counter-stories, are almost the inverse of the reality that slavery's primary purpose was generating profit.
The book is called Yuletide in Dixie, Slavery, Christmas, and Southern Memory. Our guest is the author, Professor Robert May, who is a professor emeritus of history at Purdue University, and he is back in the Finger Lakes area. He's a guest of the Seward House Museum in Auburn, and he has an event with the Seward House on Thursday night right next door. Where, Jeff Ludwig? It's at the brand new, what is it?
the brand new Equal Rights Heritage Center. It opened about this time last year, and it's a wonderful site. That's intention really is to be an anchor for Central and Western New York, and specifically to send visitors from across the state, country, world to sites of consciousness and reform, to really cue up the worthwhileness of going to the Seward House, but also to come to Rochester, go to the Harriet Tubman House and see the Frederick Douglass statue, to go to Seneca Falls, to go to Peterborough and the Garrett Smith Farm. So trying to get people to Central New York and then launch them to the many different ways that we were burned over as a region in the 1840s, 1850s with an anti-slavery impulse and sentiment. And the Sewards were at the front and center of that.
All right, so Thursday night, 7 p.m., and if you want to attend, it's free for Seward House Museum members, but also $5 is all if you're not a member, and they'd love to see you out there on Thursday evening.
We would. We've got lots of copies of Professor May's book, and he's going to be happy, I think, to autograph them, and we hope you'll come out and continue this conversation.
And can I piggyback on Jeff's comment just for a second? I think it's important to note that the anti-slavery element in the North used Christmas for fundraising, and there was a major link between the abolition movement and Christmas. Just check out the third verse of the Christmas carol, O Holy Night, and you'll see what I mean, and trace the history of the third verse.
Well, now everyone who's listening is Googling the lyrics to O Holy Night and the third verse, which you can do during our brief break. And if you also look up the cover of the book Yuletide and Dixie, all I will tell you is it is a chilling but effective image, a fantastic but dark image on the cover of Yuletide and Dixie. The author is our guest, and we're right back to some of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, New York State has new red flag gun laws. They're designed to get guns out of the hands of people who might use those guns to harm others, essentially to ward off shootings or mass shootings before they happen. But who gets to decide? What are the criteria? How do we make sure that public safety is protected while also protecting individual rights? That's next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So more of your phone calls and emails. Alex writes, who is this we and our you keep talking about? Between 1861 and 1865, over 40,000 New Yorkers died to end slavery. They knew what they were fighting for. Just as Southerners knew it was about slavery, so did Northerners. Because the narrative changed for some people, let's not forget the sacrifice our veterans made. They knew slaves weren't treated well. And by the way, yes, it was treason and about slavery, but the broad brushing of everyone as we isn't accurate. Your guests are good, but we, they're not using that phrase. Evan, you are. Not all white people are evil. From Alex. Okay, well, let me just tell you, because we talk about race a lot on this program, and I've got a big responsibility. There's exactly one microphone and one local talk show like this in Western New York. It's a huge responsibility, and I happen to be a white male. So when I say we, I don't mean that all white people are evil, Alex. What I mean is we have a history that is real, and that it was the worst parts of our history, slavery in particular, propagated by white people. I'm a white person, and I think that the acknowledgement as our and we is not to say we are all evil, but we have this collective history. And if we are dishonest about that, if we try to let the propagandists tell us it wasn't that bad, and you know there were things we misunderstood, or the war wasn't always about this, then we not only grapple with our past poorly, but we open ourselves up for failing to see what injustices currently lie among us today. And we still have a long way to go. So I think that it is important to be honest about that. But that is not to it's not to absolve anybody, and it's also not to condemn anybody. That's just a view of collective history. That's my view, and I'd love to hear the professor's view.
I would very much like to follow up on that, because it is a good question, but it also tends to obscure something very important. First of all, before the Civil War, let's talk before the Civil War, people like Stephen Douglas, who for a while lived in this part of New York, supported slavery. He supported its expansion. I wrote about that in my last book. He supported its spreading into Latin America, where he felt the climate made it appropriate for Latin American labor. And many Northerners before the Civil War, in fact, the Democratic Party, ironically, was the opposite of today. Instead of being the more liberal party, it was the more conservative party on matters of race and slavery. And the Democratic Party tended to buffer the South against Northern anti-slavery attacks. And so, in a sense, when Northern soldiers went off to war, you have the same kind of dichotomy. Thousands of these Northern soldiers, including New Yorkers, actually were tolerant of slavery and maybe didn't want it for New York, but were quite supportive of the South's right to have slavery or saw it as constitutional, since the Constitution has certain protections like a Fugitive Slave Act in it that make it clear that the Founding Fathers didn't intend, at least overnight, to abolish slavery. So what I'm saying is that before the Civil War and during the Civil War, you can't universalize the Northern experience as being anti-slavery. And many Northern soldiers treated black refugees, the escapees from the plantations and farms and cities who headed to Union lines, and they treated them terribly. They abused them. They sometimes made fun of them. And again, I wouldn't want to say that all Yankee soldiers were that way, but many of them were. In fact, in 1864, large numbers of them voted against Abraham Lincoln. They voted for his Democratic opponent, George McClellan, who had never been anti-slavery and had wanted a soft war in the South that left slavery intact. So I think that's true in the past. It was true after the Civil War, when some of these accounts of Christmas that I talk about in my book were actually written by Northerners. They were published in Northern newspapers, not as many as by white Southern men and women, but a significant number of these accounts. There were illustrators in the North who gave mild pictures of slaves getting presents at Christmas and that kind of thing. And then right up into the 20th century and the current day, there have been Northerners who for decades were unwilling to tackle segregation and racism. So I think it cuts both ways. I think your criticism is at least partially valid, but it's also, I think, too much of a generalization.
Okay. Jeff, you want to add to that?
Well, sticking to Seward again, I think, I mean, he really exemplifies the complexity of wrapping one's mind then and now around the issue of slavery. And it becomes easy. I think one of the things we try deliberately to do at the Seward House Museum is not to be a place that's always all affirming and comforting and a way to venerate heroic figures from history. Even the Sewards, who I think are on the right side of most historical issues, and I'm judging from my 21st century vantage point, go astray. And we can read in their letters at the University of Rochester and their speeches some equivocation. And I think of the way that through the first year and a half of the war, it seems like President Lincoln was willing to maintain the legality of slavery for the sake of union. If the South would return willingly, then slavery as it existed, maybe no more Western expansion, could remain on the books. And I think of William Seward during that long secession winter between Lincoln's election day and his inauguration day. He's on very good terms. He is on good terms personally with Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, putting forth that January an offer to put slavery into the Constitution in a proposed 13th Amendment that the incoming administration might support that would allow slavery to exist where it had always existed. This despite the long track record of the anti-slavery rhetoric and action of Seward, even up to in the early parts of the war. This was something that was fluid, debated, and people at the top and all the way down, I think, had to wrestle with it, grapple with it, and maybe go back and forth on it.
Yeah, and Karen emails to say, now I'm confused. When I was in school, we were taught that the Civil War was fought over slavery. In more recent times, the narrative seemed to change, and the Civil War became about preservation of the Union. I have read that President Lincoln was personally opposed to slavery. My question is, what was the primary motive for the war from the viewpoint of Lincoln, the Union, and the Confederacy? Jim and Irondequoit also called in with the same question. And the simple question is, the Confederacy wanted slavery. That's why they succeeded. That's why they seceded. Lincoln, yes, very famously in a letter to Horace Greeley, did say, His primary objective from his executive duty is to preserve the union. He added this, though, and I want to get the professor's thought. He added this in that letter to Greeley, basically saying, if I can preserve the union by getting rid of slavery, great, I'll do it. If I can preserve the union but I can't get rid of slavery, great, I'll do it. If I can preserve the union and there's some slavery here but not other places, I'll do it. It's about saving the union. He goes on to say, I have stated here my purpose according to my view of official duty. I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free.
It's a wonderful quote. Lincoln hated slavery. He apparently hated it from the time he was very young. But he also knew that attacking slavery would divide the Union and that slavery had certain constitutional protections. And so we need to remember the South left the Union. The Union did not leave the South. The South left the Union because it felt that slavery would come under attack because of Lincoln's election. Maybe tomorrow, maybe a year later, maybe 4 years later, but sooner or later it would come under serious attack. The North would have enough power either to eliminate slavery through congressional law or a constitutional amendment once it got enough anti-slavery states. And then you had more Supreme Court justices who were anti-slavery and so on and so forth. They're appointed by anti-slavery presidents. You get the picture. So the Republican Party, which Lincoln represented, had made it clear it would not let slavery expand anywhere. That meant that from that time on, unless the South somehow pulled off a miracle and got back in power, the South would lose its political power to defend slavery. That's the essential reason why they left the Union that many of them loved. They felt that slavery was endangered. And you can find this in their statements. They wrote constitutional statements justifying secession, private letters, speeches, whatever you want. You can find this. So then the Civil War starts. Lincoln is hoping, well, first of all, he's determined to keep the Union together. Four slave states stay in the Union. Delaware does not secede. Kentucky does not secede. Missouri does not secede. And Maryland does not secede. And you've got slave owners in all these states with considerable political power in some of them. You are going to drive them out of the Union the minute you attack slavery. So there are all sorts of reasons, some of them which Jeff just mentioned, why Lincoln doesn't want to wage a war on slavery. But as the war grinds on, it becomes apparent that you can't win the war without freeing the slaves. Lincoln's anti-slavery anyway, using the War Powers Clause basically, he decides to use his presidential powers against slavery, issues the Emancipation Proclamation. It brings a couple hundred thousand slaves into the Union Army effort and somewhere like 20 or 30,000 slaves into the Union Naval effort. And he gets support from Congress, which many congressmen are ahead of him on emancipation. And then Congress writes the 13th Amendment at the end of the war, freeing slaves forever in America. So I could go on for quite a ways. But the important point is, yes, Lincoln starts the war not intending to attack slavery. He even considers colonizing African Americans somewhere else, particularly in Latin America, as a way of avoiding having to emancipate them. Maybe you can get Southerners to send them away on their own and colonize Latin America and end the slavery issue. It doesn't work. African Americans aren't interested in being colonized. Northern anti-slavery elements don't support the program. And he finally realizes that he must, if he wants to win this war and restore the Union, he must free the slaves. And the slaves are running away to Union lines by the thousands anyway, forcing the emancipation decision on him.
Okay, in our last couple of minutes, by the way, Dominic says, Evan, I visited the Seward House last year. It was the best museum tour I've ever had anywhere in the world. And this is not someone related to Jeff Ludwig. That's an actual email.
Thanks, Dominic.
But 2 minutes left here. I wanted to spend more time on this, but listeners, you're going to have to pick up the book. There's a section called Sanitizing the Past. I'm going to quote from it now. Preconditioned by decades of Christmas slave revolt rumors, white communities throughout the Southland instinctively assumed blacks would capitalize on their new status and the absence of slave patrols to unleash the Yuletide mayhem of murder, rape, and pillage so long anticipated. Yet, as had been the case so often before, nothing of the sort came to pass. In our last minute,
yeah.
what do you think that fear and then the reality tells us?
The truth is that Southerners were of divided minds. They wanted to think their slaves were happy being slaves. Many of them deep down knew they weren't happy being slaves. A disproportionate number of slave revolt panics in the South had to do with fears that slaves would use their Christmas freedoms to revolt. There never was a major Christmas revolt in the South from the Revolution to the Civil War, but they feared it many Christmases. It meant mass arrests, mass executions of African Americans, some executions of whites who they suspected of fueling these slave insurrections. But to me, it's testimony to the fact that deep down, Southerners knew they were doing something immoral.
The fear of African Americans isn't necessarily gone. That's part of the problem. When people see someone walking down the street and they move to the other side of the street, the plantation owners were scared after 1865 of what was coming, even if it never came to pass. We have a long history of this. Yuletide and Dixie helps us see that. Slavery, Christmas, and Southern Memory. Robert May has been our guest for the hour, and you can meet him Thursday night. And I have so many emails I can't even get to. So listeners, if you didn't get through, go out to the Seward Museum right next door on Thursday night. Jeff, tell us real briefly what's coming up Thursday.
It's going to be a great night, a great talk, plenty of room for everybody. Check out our website, sewardhouse.org. If you want to feel good about Christmas, we do have some Victorian Christmas program coming up 3 weekends in December. Check us out. We hope to see you Thursday night, and come see us and take a museum tour.
Online where?
Sewardhouse.org.
Sewardhouse.org. It's a treasure in our region. And Professor May, safe travels. Have a great event Thursday, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a delight.
All right. Short break. More connections coming up.